2020 was that game changer for me. I went viral, brand deals started coming in, more management companies started reaching out, and I was like, oh, the amount of money I was offered for one brand deal was equal to my first job salary in America then, because I was getting paid $36,000 a year. My first Instagram reel thing was about 25K for one post.
You hear those numbers?
When did you realize you could monetize being odd and it's not something you had to fix?
Ooh, okay, how do I start?
Some people chase perfection. Others chase authenticity. And then there's Sophie, the oddity. She's the creator who reminds us that playing well is as important as performing well.
And then when 2020 happened and like I started getting traction and people were sending videos to my mom, and I could see the push and pull that was happening. I remember one particular incident, my mom had called me and she just said some really, really, really rough things to me. And I remember getting off that phone and I cried so hard, I think my eyes bled. I went into a depressive episode for months. I lost money, I didn't really post, I didn't do anything. And I wasn't sure how to communicate that to her, that you might think I'm happy because you're happy, but you're forgetting that you're happy and I'm not.
Sophie.
Yeah.
What did it look like from a boundaries perspective where you're still Sophie?
Yeah.
But then there's the oddity.
Yeah.
And then sometimes people blur the lines between the two.
Yeah.
Right. So what does that look like and how did you navigate the two?
Ooh. We see the tweets. And every single day, what we see is we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you. Sophie, so when people tune into this podcast and click your specific episode, they may be winding down from a long day, they may be working out, they may be going on a road trip. So the first thing I want you to tell our audience is, why should someone be an African creator? And why is it the best time now?
Oh my God. I think it's... impact is usually a beautiful thing and impact is necessary. And I think when we see the industry that we're in right now, especially when I was like creating, I didn't see people who look like me, especially African creators. But what we did hear were stories, right? I remember I would be in secondary school, right? We'd be watching Vampire Diaries and you'd be doing like the Korean dramas then. And you'd also be seeing the Hannah Montana, Will Smith, all that stuff. And then when you see the African stories, the ads that'll come up, right? And you would see the fly with a young kid and stuff like that. Now, when you go on TikTok and you search Lagos, Nigeria, you see Lagos Fashion Week is happening. You see Come With Me to Move to Lagos. You see Tanzania. You see Rwanda. You hear stories that aren't suffering. But are everyday people like us living lives on the continent. I think we have begun to tell our stories and we see from the young perspective, from the old perspective, from everyone in between. I think that's really what's special about having creators, especially African creators, have a voice in our industry now.
Mm. And you know, one thing that I really love about your brand is that you have like, I don't want to say it's like a community, right? Mm-hmm. And oddities. And so I want you to talk about, when did you realize you could monetize being odd and it's not something you had to fix?
I think it took me a minute to understand monetization. And I say a minute in terms of I was one of those folks who started creating not for the money or for the influence I could potentially get, but because I just really wanted to share. I would go online and I would want to write my own version of stories, right? My own things I loved to write. So I started actually with a blog. And I think that was when the blog era was a thing and you'd have folks teaching you how to have the best blog and how to get on Google and stuff like that, especially when I was going through my undergrad journey. And I think as I started getting noticed by brands, the conversation about money came up. And I remember... I had a fun story, actually. I had a Venezuelan colleague or student who I promise you, we did not know each other from anywhere. We're both international students. She was also a creator and she'd been creating for about 5 years then. And for some reason, she came up to me and she was like, I have a blog too. Let's connect. And she would tell me how much she was charging. And her rates were so crazy to me at that point. I'm like, you're charging $1,000 and you have like maybe 20,000 followers at this point. And that was huge at the time. So it was 2017, 2018. And I remember when I would get offers, it would be for $150. It would be for $50. It would be for $30. And of course, I didn't have the big following then, but I just knew that because there wasn't a lot of people who looked like me, that means my own impact was even larger. Because if you're serving 5% of the population, you know you're targeting 5%. That's a huge margin versus trying to target 100% and getting one. And so at the end of the day, what I realized was if I was not shaking when I was giving these offers, then I wasn't doing the right thing. And that's when monetization came into play. I remember my first deal was with Home Depot and they paid me $7,500. And I think I had like maybe 5 to 10,000 followers at the point. So nothing crazy for an Instagram post and I think stories. And that to me was like $7,500 was like going to pay my my tuition at that point. And since then, I've never backed down from making sure I understood my worth and monetizing that.
Wait, actually, interesting. I want to double click on that. So Home Depot, why Home Depot? How did they even find you? Like, walk us through that story.
That was a crazy time. So I was currently getting I just graduated from my undergrad. I was going into grad school. And I remember getting reached out because they were looking for folks who were going to transform their dorm rooms at that point. And I usually did dorm content transformation videos, thankfully. And so they just randomly reached out to me and said, do I have an apartment in my university? Am I still interested? And I was like, yeah, actually, I still live on campus. I would love to, you know, get this opportunity. And paid me the money, got me, I think I have my first art painting from a Home Depot, actually. People come into my house and they're like, who's that from? I'm like, Home Depot. That's how I got it. And it's still with me till today as like my first like prize. But yeah, that was essentially what happened. And I was one of two creators. And the other creator had, I think, 50,000 followers then compared to my 10K. And it was a white guy. So I don't know how much it was paid then, but I remember after the campaign going through our numbers and seeing that I outnumbered like everything. It was so necessary for me to see and also for me to understand that my worth was also special. Because very rarely do you see Black girls going to Home. Like Home Depot is a very like white, macho and American institution type thing. And we also didn't realize that for a lot of young Black girls going into college and transitioning, Home Depot is also where they built a lot of their things too. So, yeah.
So, Sophie, we all know as African children, our parents don't encourage us to necessarily go into the creatives, right? So what was the thing you wanted to go, that they sent you to school for? What did they pay school fees for? And what was that conversation like with your parents? Like, look, oh, this thing I went to school for is not necessarily what is about to shape me in my career. And what was that moment? Because every one of us who's in this field remembers the moment when the thing our parents sent us to school for, they keep saying, please though, it's like you're going to become a useless person. And then the minute the first check lands and they're like, oh, so it's making money. Okay, cool. So what was that transition for you?
So my mom is a single mom. So she has me and my brother, blood kids. Anyways, my dad has 12 children. That's a long story for a different day. We all know the stories. But growing up, the story was my brother was going to be a doctor. I'll be a lawyer. Before he did, my brother decided to be a doctor for real. And so I was left to be the lawyer because we're 10 years apart. And I remember going through, you know, I went to secondary school in Nigeria, home science, shout out to home science. And then after secondary school, I actually went to University of Ilorin for a year. And that's where I did my first 100 level. That feels like such a crazy time in my life because I never really thought I was going to go to school in Nigeria. I always had the dreams of like, I want to go to school in America, but money, funds is just not feasible for us to travel. So I was going to start in Ilorin, be a lawyer, do the whole international law thing, maybe get a law degree somewhere in America at some point in my life. And at some point while, and this is important to the story, I promise. At some point while doing my 100 level, I was approached by a professor who essentially ended up sexually harassing me. Mm-hmm. So in this particular conversation, I remember being in 100 level then, I would be a part of the fashion show, be a part of the vocal. Like I want to be seen. I loved entertainment. I loved art. I loved fashion. I loved beauty. I was never in some way like the stoic law student, because you know you always hear in Nigeria it's that child who's always loud in school is the one that's going to be a lawyer. They never think of you to be a writer or an actor or something else like that. It's usually just, oh, you talk too much, you argue, you're going to be a lawyer. They don't think of anything past that for the creatives. So I remember getting called into this professor's office and sitting down in front of him. This is, I think I'm 15 going on 16 at this time, and sits me down and he's like, I'm wearing the black and white university thing, the lanyard, and he goes, you're going to be reporting to my chambers every Tuesday and Thursday in Okeado, or something like that. And I said, oh, for what's that? He's like, I've handpicked you specially. And I'm like, what's handpicked me for what? And then he goes on to say that you're going to be servicing me until you finish here if you want to pass. And I remember thinking, if I want to pass, like, what are you talking about? And now it kind of hit me, because you hear rumors, you hear stories, and you sort of wonder, oh, it will never be me, or is it these ghost stories, where they really weren't? And that was my experience for the next 3 months in the school, where constantly harassed by him, I ended up being sexually assaulted by him through that process. And I remember calling my mom and saying, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm leaving, I'm going. And the conversation then, and no fault of hers, was, it's because you're always out there. It's because you're always getting seen. It's because you're always too much. Oh, when you lost school, when you look away, you won't go read. You're always going to be da 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 da. And a part of me would say, if I was in America, though, this wouldn't have happened to me, which is not true, because we also have all these sort of cases back in America. But ended up getting a scholarship that helped me, applied, going to school. And America was a changing point for me, because then I was like, our society here is ruled a lot by shame. And our society here, especially for women, is ruled by your purpose and how you serve the family in a few ways. It's changing now, but when I was growing up, 2014, 2015 was, you finish school, you get your degree, if anything, get a job, potentially, if not potentially, find a husband who will take care of you, give birth to children, go away. And I'm from a Muslim home too. So that's even earlier. I should have settled down early and I should have had my nikah and done all these things. But America gave me the opportunity to think and dream past what my family was telling me to do. And so I remember going to political science and still doing the pre-law track, because I had to do pre-law. And when I finished my undergrad, I finished in 2018, but I started my blog in 2017. And that was when I said the Home Depot check started coming in. A follower started coming. I started writing about life in America and my personal experiences. And I got so many responses from young African, Nigerian, Black women who just related to me not wanting to fit that mold. And so I just sort of had this moniker, this alter ego of Oddity, somewhere in the corner. My mom didn't know about it. My family members kind of saw, but no one said anything. So it was like she was the secret for about 3 years. Oddity was just not.
And what year was this?
2018. So 2017 to 2019, essentially, Oddity was a secret. I think my mom found out in 2020, I think, that I had a social media. Like, she found out when my damn video went viral and it was a whole thing. But then I got my master's. I was supposed to go to law school, but American law school is expensive. So it was okay, we'll get a master's. Peace and conflict studies, because that would be a good track for international law. So all this while I'm still thinking, okay, well, I'm still going to be this lawyer, but in the back of my mind, I have this Oddity pocket thing that would help me. And I think at some point, 2020 was that game changer for me. The world shut down. I was an international student who essentially now had to either try to find a job before the pandemic, or not even knowing that before the pandemic, but try to find a job so I could stay in the country, try to figure all this out, and also continue this growing audience online. And I went viral. Brand deals started coming in. More management companies started reaching out. And I was like, oh, the amount of money I was offered for one brand deal was equal to my first job salary in America then, because I was getting paid $36,000 a year for a nonprofit job, because I had a nonprofit job at the time after graduating. And my first, I think, Instagram story or Instagram real thing was about $25,000 for one post. $36,000 a year for $25,000 per post.
You hear those numbers?
It made no sense for me to decide, oh, I will follow this law track. Please, no. God, no. So I think that was when I decided to change. And my mom still did not know how much I was making, because for her, it's from a Muslim background, and I've said this a lot in my podcast, a woman shouldn't be making money, essentially. Like, your money is necessary. Your money is for the home. Like, you're out, you're too outside, right? You should be at home. You should be, you're supposed to be this calm, covered sort of child. Yeah. Essentially, that's what we're taught. So I don't even think I got to experience they're not stressing you because you're making money now. Because she didn't even understand that I could make money. In my last episode with my mom, actually, even then, she made this comment that makes me chuckle. She was like, I had to ask around that, which man is financing her, which man is funding her lifestyle. Because for her too, she couldn't understand that. No, yeah. These brands are, especially because they're not Muslim brands too. So if I'm telling her Spotify is flying me out to Nigeria for a brand deal, who is Spotify? What does Spotify want from you? Like, why are they asking you? Who is Spotify? Is it a man that is Spotify? Is it, you know what I mean? So I still haven't gotten that. I'm a breadwinner, so they're not disturbing you yet. But I think it's also because I'm a woman, I'm a young girl, and I'm also not as modest as most people would like me to be. I'm very open about my life, my journey. So I wish I could get that, but I don't. And that's okay because I'm happy exactly as I am.
You know, it's so funny because it's now that I recognize the similarities between me and you. I did political science.
Yeah.
I definitely ended up doing law school. Actually, I went for a master's in political science because I didn't want to do law school. But after political science, I didn't know what to do in my life. So I said, I might as well cuckoo do the law school that they've been telling me to do. But within that, right, I think even from Nigeria before I moved, I think I told you when we were on your podcast that I moved at 15. Mm-hmm. There was always this tension of, I know how I am, but it feels like what my family wants from me is not what is going to serve me. Mm-hmm. And if I follow this their track, I feel like there's unhappiness at the end of this tunnel. What was that decision for you internally where you were like, look, I'm going to choose my freedom and I will pay the cost and pay the price for that freedom no matter what it is? What was that conversation for you in your head? And what was that moment where you realized I am willing to pay that price?
So when I moved to America, I think most of us would either land in the uncle or auntie's house, right? So I landed in my uncle's house and I wasn't necessarily staying with him, but he was that like safe haven for me because we were best friends. My uncle was like my pseudo dad. Like he was my dad. And I remember when I first started content and creating, I think this was around 2018. So this was around the time I cut my hair. And some long story short, he said, you know, if I don't stop social media, if I don't start covering my hair, he would have nothing to do with me. And I remember like, oh, this is not possible. It's not true. It's not true. It's not going to happen. But it did end up happening. He kind of ostracized me. If I could say, if it was my dad, I would say like he disowned me essentially. And it was essentially what happened. I've not spoken to my uncle in 7-8 years since then. And I remember when my mom knew about our issues, but she wasn't really sure what the crux of it was. And then when 2020 happened and like I started getting traction and people were sending videos to her, sending what was happening, I remember I was so happy because my dreams were kind of coming true. Like I could see the life I wanted for myself and I could feel so contented and happy. But there was a part of me, because I'm a huge mommy's girl. I'm a huge family girl. I love my family down. I'm all like that. And I could see the sort of like the push and pull that was happening because I knew my mom hated what made me happy. I knew it in the core. It made her so unhappy. I mean, like she would throw herself down the stairs. She would call me crying. She would say I was the worst child she'd ever had. Love you, mommy. She would say like, and this is African parents. If you're an African child, you've heard this. They would guilt you into thinking you're the worst thing that ever happened to them. And they forget that they've lived their life. And it's just time for you to live yours. And the best they could do is guide, right? And I remember one particular incident, my mom had called me and she just said some really, really, really rough things to me. And I remember getting off that phone and I cried so hard. I think my eyes bled. Like it was so bad. And I went into a depressive episode for months. I lost money. I didn't really post. I didn't do anything. And I was unhappier because then when I wasn't posting, she was talking to me. But she did not fill that void that I was missing. And I wasn't sure how to communicate that to her, that you might think I'm happy because you're happy, but you're forgetting that you're happy and I'm not. And so I think I just started therapy. I did therapy and my first therapy session, I tried to explain to her, like, oh, I'm an African child and you can't really not say no to your parents because it's not possible or else they're gonna hate you for life. And an American therapist, of course, is like, oh, like, what are you? Is it your parents? Like, what are you talking about here? And I remember, like, having to explain culture and tradition and protocol and this is, no, like, you're not getting it. Like, no, I can't do this because my mom says no. She was like, how old are you again? I was like, no, you're not getting it. Like, I can't. I'm an African child. Like, I can't live my life. Like, I'm living my life for my family. And as I remember saying, I'm living my life for my family. No one should ever have to say that. So I think that was a turning point for me. I remember like that first therapy session when I heard myself say, I can't do something because I can't live my life for my family. It just was like a ding, ding, ding of, if they go, what then? The life that you're unhappy with, what will happen to it? You're going to keep being unhappy about it. You're going to now change. Everybody's going to say, oh, what was happening? So I think that changed for me. And then I think ever since I've just not looked back, I'm just, if whatever we want to happen, will happen. We're here now. She's coming out from a flight home soon. And she's asking me, oh, so business class, what I'll be? I said, so. So look at us now, 5 years later. So,
but she still doesn't understand what you're doing. Interesting.
My mom is 65. So, and she's not, I'm not saying she's not technologically savvy, but I think, especially from my Muslim background perspective, I think it's really interesting that I am making a living off of my personality and who I am. Like, it's a really hard thing to communicate, especially if she doesn't understand what that even looks like. Like, if I'm dressing up, or I'm doing fashion, I'm doing interviews, all that stuff, like, she just doesn't get it. And I was really frustrated at some point because I was trying to explain it to her, but I could tell, like, she just wasn't understanding. But not, I think she's gotten also to a point where she's happy enough for me. Like, she's just like, okay, so Spotify, Abby. What's wrong with Spotify again? I'll Google it. And then she'll send me a screenshot of what she Googled about Spotify. I'll say, well, me, it's close enough. That's fine. So I'm okay with it.
Etche, remember that time I walked into a bank? I'm not going to give the name. And I asked them for $1,000. And they told me, no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset. And I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have VBAN as a sponsor of the Afropolitan podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast. So actually, I want to go back to the viral moment, mm-hmm. right? I want you to talk about what made you create that video specifically. Did you think anything of it was going to happen? And what were the consequent steps that happened afterwards when that happened?
I think it was, I don't know if I can curse on here.
No, but, yeah, you
oh,
can.
Oh, yeah, okay. I think one of my biggest videos was, I'm a bad bitch with my black bits. And
yes,
it was,
I remember. Yeah.
And it was at a point in life where I was just having fun on Snapchat, honestly. And I sent a video to my friends about how my butt looked good in some jeans. And she said, just post it. Because at that point, I'd always been a writer, like a very, like, if I go back to my blog post, I was a very emo girl. Like, I used to be very, because I think I was also tussling with this background issue. Nobody really could understand why, like, I wasn't just choosing to be happy. I was like, I can't be happy if my family's unhappy with me. And so my friends, though, were like my safe space. So I would send them videos of me being goofy. I remember that friend, shout out to Ore. She was like, post it on Twitter. Like, just post this thing. Like, you're so funny. You're so hilarious. People need to see this. Why are you always posting write-ups? Do videos too. Everybody's doing videos now. So I posted a video. I think it got like 12 million views at the time on Twitter. I said, 12 million views is crazy. Posted it on Instagram. It did really well. And I just started posting more videos of me talking online. And before then, I'd never realized that I had a personality that I could share. And because I also didn't have a film or creative background in any way, I still never understood what it meant to just put on a show. And so after learning that, oh, like me, I could be an entertainer. I can stand in rooms and host, and it comes naturally to me. I love the camera. I started looking at other opportunities to do so. So I love to tell creators that viral moments could happen anytime. Like, this Doechii Anxiety song was one of my viral videos that just happened recently. But what happens after? And so for me, I was very strategic, and I knew I really wanted to be a host, a personality, a presenter. I want to act. So I'm hoping acting classes are happening right now. I'm really excited. So I reached out to a bunch of agencies to start chatting with them just to see what the lay of the land was. I started actually planning strategy, started doing community. Like, I started doing all these things to make sure I started building that community around it. Because you can have 50 viral videos, but not have a core community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of creators right now are chasing viral moments, when viral moments will come and go. But at the core of it, you want to make sure you have 100 people, 1,000 people, 100,000 people who are bought into not that viral moment of yours, but you as a person. So there are people who now, who might only know me from, I'm a bad bitch, my Black Bits. The people right now who know me from being bald. The people right now who know me from my podcast. So those are moments where I want to make sure at the core of it, they know that, oh, that oddity is this bald girl who does this. Yeah.
What did it look like for you, especially as, you know, it started to grow, right? Yeah. You're talking about financially, you're talking about like you're basically everywhere, yeah. right? How did that affect your friendships, your relationship with family, people, how people perceive you? Because I think sometimes, I mean, we've talked about this offline, right? Which is you're still Sophie,
yeah.
but then there's the oddity.
Yeah.
And then sometimes people blur the lines between the two, yeah. right? So what does that look like and how did you navigate the two?
I mean, Chica, we were just talking about a few of these conversations the other day.
Yes,
too.
Literally. Yeah.
It's been a work in progress. Again, I think being a woman has a lot to do with like the navigating this space. The influencer world can be very toxic, but at the same time, it's afforded me a lot of opportunities. I will say in terms of family, I'm still La Dironke at the core of it. Like nothing is ever going to change. I have friends who keep me grounded, who make me feel balanced, who understand the nuance of my life. And I really don't think I'm famous yet. I don't even think I'm close to fame. I think I'm still at 0.5% of my capacity. And what that means for me is my potential is still so big and there's so much more to come. I will say I have learned to protect my peace and understand that within the creator economy, folks are colleagues, not best friends. Because when your personal life is content in a way, those lines tend to get blurred. So I remember like one of my first managers, I used to think she's my girl. That's my bestie. That's your manager. That's not your bestie. Okay. At the end of the day, like their 10% or 20% is going to get cut. They're going to want that information. So I had to learn quickly that I had to make Sophie be the boss, this needs to get done for Oddity to get protected. So I think Beyonce Sasha Fierce is a good example of that. Like Oddity is here, she's putting on a show, but at the core of it, when everything comes off, Sophie's still able to just stay grounded and be grounded and move around the world being intentional about it. Because my life is my reality. Like I think I'm one of the few creators who essentially is constantly just talking about her life. I'm not curating anything. My content isn't something that I have to think about. I am just setting up the camera and talking to the camera. And honestly, I get inspired a lot by some of what the white girls do. Because if you can go through life as a white person, you understand. I'm so sick, guys. I learned a lot from white people. I'm so serious because when you go through life as a white person, you have no problems. Like, You wake up, your family's, you know, sometimes you're like, for the most part, like the stories we hear, what I've seen too, you wake up, there's no racism bothering you like that. There's no suffering. You don't have to think about it. Mom, I want to start doing, you know, tennis. Okay, girl. Like, here's the, like, it's so easy. Like, there's a certain level of like bravado that yes. white, especially white men, ooh, wee, like they just live life to be lived. So I started doing that, right? And I started realizing that because there's a lot that's impacted the Black community, the African community, Nigerian community, we've been talking so for a long time about that, that again, our community is ruled by pressures and opinions and shame and routine and processes because you just don't want to shift. You don't want to shake. You don't want to change. But then white people, they just be talking to talk. And I'm not necessarily taking that to mean I have to do the same, but it's teaching me that sometimes it's helpful to simply just be myself and see where that takes me.
What did it look like from a boundaries perspective, right? Because think about it, like Sophie is writing and she's blogging, right? But your friends are maybe reading your write-ups, but then you transition to Instagram, to TikTok, to whatever platforms that you're getting paid, like you said, 25K to post.
Yeah.
And then a friend is like, oh, I'm doing this one event or I'm doing this one thing. Do you mind helping me post this or whatever? And expecting it's like, yo, Sophie, I mean, you would have helped me post it before you blew up. What did it look like when you had to establish boundaries, like business boundaries with people who you're even close to and say, hey, go through my manager, go through my agent, go through, you know, my agency, right? What did that look like for you? And how did you have those difficult conversations?
Maybe I'm just wicked because I've never done it. Like I've never been the person who simply gave shout outs. I've never been the person because I will say that I would explain to people that those shout outs don't necessarily work because it doesn't do anything for you. I remember when I first started, like I was trying really hard to grow. I'll be the follow for follow or like, please help me. It was time with like the BlackBerry Messenger where you're telling people like, Twitter. Oh, just follow me small. If you put on your status here, we always did that. But then people will follow maybe once and then they won't follow you.
Yeah.
Or if I post your brand and it has nothing to do with me, my core community would know that. So now, actually, a recent case just happened. A really big brand and really big creator who I consider someone who I really respect reached out to me for their company and their content. And I never tried their stuff. And they were like, oh, we want you to be an ambassador for it. We want you to do all this face. I love you. Like, you're great. And I was just like, out of everything you just said, you've not even said, do you want to try my products? And I had to tell her that. I was like, you've not actually asked me to try your product. You don't know if it's going to work for me. You don't know if I'm going to like it. So how would you expect me to then be an ambassador for something because you want to pay me? And sometimes you never want to pay me well. You want to just pay me because you want to pay me something just so you could say we're keeping a relationship. And I know that sometimes burns bridges. That sometimes makes people feel upset. But I like to explain it to them as like, if it was you, you wouldn't do this too.
Yeah.
And so when I asked for the products, I think they were taken aback a bit of like, no, the products are great. Oh, what if it's not great for me? And then what? So I learned really early on to set boundaries. And I think it always helped out. My mom was a politician, right? So I've always learned to, you know,
navigate
that a little bit more. I know how to be the, I'm so sorry, I can't do that. Like, I'm the kind of person that if you come with me and say, can you follow me on my phone? I'll be like, oh, no. Oh, why? Oh, no, I don't want to. Like, I wouldn't watch your content now. Why would I lie to you about it? And you're like, oh, but you're supposed to support me. Yeah, but I think support comes organically. Like, if I see yourself and I like it, I will follow. And if not, that's okay too. I think with social media, people like to make it too personal when it really isn't. It is a business. Like, we are business entities. We're creators. And I think the market in Nigeria is a bit different because we're just getting onto that understanding of business. Creators are businesses. But I think it's already happening in America where people understand that creators are businesses.
You know, it's funny because I feel like I told Chika that I feel like Sophie does this thing where people want to underestimate her because she'll be like, oh, I'm like this. Or maybe like some people might perceive you as an airhead. And I'm like, people don't realize that that's where she's going to bill you. I don't underestimate you. Get built. So I want you to explain, like, how many times have you been underestimated and you can tell that they're perceiving you and they're like, oh, she's an influencer. She might not know about politics. She might not know about business. She might not know about this. And what does it look like internally for you to be like, I know what you're doing, but I'm going to catch you in front. What is that? What does that process look like for you?
Oh, Lord. I love that you just triggered me in the best way, because I'm going to say the story I've never said before out loud. I think all my core friends know it. This is a bit of some tea, some you know. But when I first went viral, there's a huge creator who I was like the biggest fan of. And I remember getting a DM from her. And she was like, oh my God, I would love to chat with you, learn it from you, like understand what your goals are, what the direction you have going on. And so we hop on a call and it was about a 20-30 minute call where I'm just yapping because I'm just excited. Like, I don't know anybody in this industry, but you're one of the OGs. Like, you're one of these Black creator OGs. Like, I need to understand where I need to go. And because you're just talking about like, what do you do after viral moments, right? I've seen this woman do viral moments and continue to capitalize on that. And so we're talking. I'm yapping away. She's so responsive and everything. She's like, okay, like, I'll keep in touch. Like, I'll keep in touch. You're good. She forgets to end the call. And so as I say bye, I don't think she realized she didn't end the call. And I remember just hearing her say to a friend passing by, because she said, oh, sorry, I have to go. My friend is here. And she went, oh, this one won't last long. And I remember hearing that. I didn't say anything. And then her and her friend laughed a bit. She was like, oh, yeah, like, this will not last long, Jerry. I beg, you know, it was a waste of my time, like a waste of my time. And I just ended the call. And I never heard from her again. She unfollowed me. Nothing. It was just, and moments like that have happened to me a lot during my time as a creator. And I think I understood that it's because I'm not calculating. I'm not strategic anyway. In the way people think I am not. Let me explain that. I know my worth. I know where I want to be. I know what I want to do. I know who I am. I have studied. I have learned. I've done it all. But I am also so me. It might come off as an airhead or she doesn't know what she's just yapping to yap. Everything I do is intentional. From how much I want to share, from how little I share, from people I have in my circle, and that's because I've learned from the best, but I also have really good people around me. So that has happened to me too many times to count. I've had creators who I'll go to events with and they'll wonder, oh, what are you doing here? How did you get into the spaces? Who's your management? Who's your agent? How did you get here? why your number is not the same as this number? Or how did you get paid here? You live in this apartment? You moved to New York and you're taking over? Oh, that's that. I'm looking at them like, oh, it's okay. Because I want to tell people that, like, you can still win even when you're not so uptight or so covered or so shielded. You can still win by simply being you. Like, at the end of the day, like, I would always be excited. I would always be joyful. I would always be fun. I would always be oversharing. I'll always tell you my dreams. I would never hide behind, I don't want people to know what my next move is. Oh, you will know, because I've posted it in my vlog last week that this is my plan for next week. Because it makes me feel good and I enjoy it. So yeah.
It's so crazy you said that, because we had lunch the other day and I remember we talked about being a consecrator is not easy. There's a lot of backstabbing. I can't name, there's quite a few people who are close to me who got close to me because they were like, oh, she's a creator too. How can I like get something from her? How can I extract something from her? So I think that's also an issue that creators we constantly face. Yeah. And I think something that Eche also mentioned as well is there's an element of vanity. Mm-hmm. And so when you're dealing with a lot of people who may be a little bit more vain, then you're going to have to deal with those issues, all right, and challenges. So I want you to now talk about Sophie the Mogul, mm-hmm. right? I want you to break down the business of content creation, because I know so many people don't understand when it's time to get a manager, when is it time to get an agent, when is it time to connect to these people. How do brands approach you? How to position? So I want you to just kind of demystify that a bit for our audience. Yeah.
Ooh, okay. How do I start? Because I there's so many ways you can get into it. So I'm going to tell you how and I can tell you like another way.
Yeah.
So when I first started, I was doing this myself. I was my fake manager. I was my fake. So there are options that people do. But when I first started, essentially as a creator first, I want you to know that you're sharing your passion. That's at the core of content creation. It is your passion. And what I mean by that is, I'm not saying if you're an editor, you want to edit, you want to be, that's a different profession. But I mean, if you want to be a content creator who's creating content off a passion, you start with documenting that passion. If you want to work with brands, start working towards working with that brand. So if you're someone who wants to work with Amex, then start talking about Amex. If you want to work with Max, start talking about Max. Start talking about Sephora. Start talking about Volkswagen or any brand you want to work with, right? Show the concept, show the proof, show what you can do. And so for a lot of creators, if you're a first timer starting out, right? First 2-3 years, and that seems like a long time in today's age, I promise you, but that's okay. First 2-3 years is showing what you can do. So, and that's why I tell a lot of people to still have a job, like still have that 9-to-5, still have something that's giving you stability. Because unless you're chasing viral moments and chaos and, oh, I want to just get those pranks and all those things, I'm not talking to those kind of people. I'm talking about someone who wants to have this be their business. Because I think a lot of people struggle with the fact that they think social media is going to be the end in 5 years. Or what influencers are going to do? How are they going to keep growing? I want to see 70-year-old influencers. And that's going to happen because the industry is not slowing down anytime soon. So as a newbie, you're going to spend first 2-3 years documenting, right? At this point, brands are going to be reaching out to you for PR. Sometimes you're going to accept them. Sometimes you're going to accept gifting. I think as you start growing, you would have an idea of when your audience is able to be monetized. So this could be as simple as if you want them to sign up for an email list to see how many people will actually click that link. If you have 1,000 views and 10 people are clicking your link, maybe you're not there yet. So maybe wait till you have 100 people clicking your link. So now you know that if a brand sends you something that they want you to promote, you know for sure that give or take 50 to 150 people will click this. Maybe 20 people will buy it. So now you're getting somewhere, right? Because people forget the metrics behind it. So I've heard influencers who were posting, they're like, oh, I want to work with this brand, but then they don't want to work with me. They want to give me my rates. And I look at their engagement and I'm like, if you have 20,000 folks and you have 20 comments or 20 likes, how sure are you that those 20 people are actually going to buy the product? You're not. So we can't sort of have this
entitlement.
Entitlement is the word with brands, because they're also trying to cover their own bases. So as a creator, understand what your metrics are. And I'm someone who loves to do the deep dive. Me and my manager talk about it all the time. I'm like, okay, I know this brand is going to do well with my audience. So I'm going to make sure I'm talking more about this. That's just how it should work. So you're going to start that. Once you feel like you're at that space of monetization, that's where representation comes in. I have representation. I don't think everyone needs to have. If you feel like you are at the point where you can't handle pitch emails and sending emails to brands or responding to emails, then maybe it's time to get representation. Because for a lot of creators, representation comes with access. and ease, right? So in the American context, at least, an agency or an agent or a brand or a manager, they tend to, if I'm with one of the big ones, CAA, for example, right? CAA probably has access to millions of brands. They have access to tourism boards. They have access to so-and-so. So the reason why I would want to join a CAA is because I know I would have access to all those things too. When I'm alone, it's harder for me to get that access. So maybe you're at a point where you need that. That's when you start looking for representation. I have a personal manager and I met her through, I was a part of the YouTube Black Creator Fund. And I was at the point then where I was like, okay, I think I don't want an agency because I'd done the agency route where I just had a big agency and I was just signed by them and they would give me deals here and there. But I realized most of the deals I was getting were inbounds. And what they call inbounds are deals that come into your email versus deals that happen when you pitch out. So I was like, maybe I actually don't need an agency, but I really wanted somebody who was able to fight for me while I was also busy doing all the creating. Because I really enjoy, I hate the admin work, but I love creating. So I got my personal manager through my YouTube Black Creator Fund, just some connections of LinkedIn search. Like, and if you're looking for management too, and you think you're at that point, go on LinkedIn. The people who are talent managers on there, go on Twitter, Threads, whatever, to try to find someone who fits your vibe. I think me and my manager talked for 3 to 6 months just to even get the feel of what we did or what we like each other or not and love her down. And then we both then decided to start shopping around for agencies. And as luck would have it, a few agencies were already in my email looking to see if I was looking for representation. And then we just met with them and I just told them, hey, I really just want to be a part of this agency because of this, but tell me how you would help me. And then me and my manager decided to go to an agency. So how I do it is my manager and my agency split 20%. So my manager gets 10%, my agency gets 10%. Some folks have a manager and agency under one agency and they all get the 20%. I wanted to get the best of both worlds, which is my manager has her connections and she's like a dog with a bone. Like if she wants to get something done, she's going to fight for it. And my agency has all the access I need. And my agency is really large. So I didn't want to put all my eggs in that basket because if I do and I'm not viral today, then they're going to forget about me. That's what agencies do. And yeah. I don't blame them for that. But if I have a manager who needs to eat because she needs to feed herself and her family, she's going to be up my agency's ass to make sure Sophie needs something today. What are we having? What are we doing?
We need something today.
We need to figure it out. Because sometimes agencies are also salaried.
Yeah.
So if you have an agent who's salaried, they're not really chasing your commission or your
skin
thing
in the game.
Because there's no skin in the game. Mm. So that's essentially how I've done representation. And it's worked really well for me. And I love, 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 love my team right now. And so there's that part of it. Other parts could be, again, just waiting till you're monetized, seeing if you're good, and then having the same thing of an agency that would represent you and they would give you a manager and give you an assistant, all that stuff too.
I'm so glad you broke this down.
Because it's so funny. I tell Chika all the time, right? When it comes to working with people, mm-hmm. if it's not skin in the game, I don't want to hear
you
it.
Don't wanna, yeah.
And I see it all the times in businesses where people are pitching you things. I'm like, yeah, but where's your skin in the game in this? Like,
how do you want, yeah.
So, I mean, just go on, but I'm glad that she reiterated that. I always tell her, like, don't bring these people to me. Skin in the game is the only thing I play.
He has seen the shege I've dealt with representation. Mm-hmm. It's been very, very difficult mm-hmm. because I feel like, and this is why I asked you this question, and I think a lot of creators are going to get a lot of value from it. It's because, especially for the Black community, yeah. there's a few agencies that are top of mind that yes. everybody wants to be represented, yeah. right? I've spoken to some of these creators that represented at said agencies and they have not had a good experience, yeah. right? I have been represented by large agencies and felt like I was just another number, yeah. right? So I feel like it's so important that you date the person that's going to represent you mm-hmm. and ask yourself, do I need to be represented by a major agency? Because
yeah.
right now I'm a signed author, right? And what I realized is that the agency I'm working with is a literary boutique agency. Mm. So they're going to understand my positioning. I don't have to explain myself.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I was approached by a big talent agency, yeah. right? That represents Hollywood and all the people. But when we had conversations, I was like, you don't see me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to put myself into your box to mm-hmm. fit into your program. I need you to fit in my program,
yeah.
right? So I really love that you broke that down because I think a lot of people see the CAAs and the WMEs and all these other ones and they're like, oh, I need, you know, and it's like, but they might not be the yeah. best fit for you. So yeah. I think it's really important. And I even want to dig deeper because I remember you had a viral moment with your apartment.
Oh, I did. Yes, girl.
And people could not fathom
how much I was paying.
It's shocking.
Yeah. So, Britt, like, what happened? Because did you think people were going to have such a weird reaction to it?
Actually, sorry, Sophie, before you answer, I want to add to that, right? Because when we watched it, and it went back to the conversation we had on your podcast, it's us in the diaspora. We know how expensive New York is.
Yeah.
We know how expensive San Francisco is. But when you're doing a podcast and your audience is global, right?
Yeah.
People are like, yo, this much for an apartment in New York. It's like, crazy. No, fam, she's not even top 20% in New York. It's that expensive, right? Yeah. So what is that distinction, especially from a diaspora angle, when you're talking about money and it's normal in the circle you're in versus when it's crossed over to other emerging markets that can't fathom that?
Yeah. Actually, I don't know if it's a calculator somewhere, but I remember when I first started getting flack for that, I just told someone to calculate it for me. So I was like, if I'm paying, let's say $7K a month and it's 12 months, how much is that? 7 times 12?
Don't worry.
84.
If that's, you know, 84. We deep political science. It wasn't math.
It wasn't math. I think it's 84th. Am I right? Is it 84? I'll be very proud of me if it's right. But let's double check to see.
Quick. So 12 times what?
7.
Times 7. 84, yeah. Oh. Look at you.
So 84,000. And I told someone who had just called me then, I was like, oh, that could be 2 brand deals in a month.
Yeah.
Or that could be a brand deal for like a 6-month session. And that's just one out of hopefully 50 brand deals I'll get in a year. And when I said that, they went, oh. I said, yeah. So why are you shouting at me? Like, it's fine. Like, this is not... something that I would say I'm doing just for the vibe of it. I think it was very intentional. I'll also say, and I don't think I've ever said this before, I actually regret that. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. And it was not from the monetary aspect, but from when I was trying to figure out, after my master's program, I was trying to figure out what was next for me. And me and Chika talked about the rat race the other day. I will also talk about Nomad and why this is important to me too. But I remember thinking, what's next? And for any creator, usually the big dogs in the game are New York and LA. And I thought to myself, okay, I want to live in New York. And I would go on YouTube and watch a ton of videos on like New York creators, go on TikTok. And they all were mostly white girls, Asian girls. White and Asian girls. They dominate the YouTube space. Love them down. Love Michelle Choi. Love my fam. Like, love them. But they dominated the New York space. No one looked like me. And that was something that I also understood. And I knew I was making money and I knew I could afford it. So my thought process then was, I want to invest in myself. And to put myself in the New York rat race market, it was the New York apartment tours, New York fancy apartment, New York high-rise apartment. Those are the click words, everything. But I also love a good home. If you know me, you know I love a view. I love a home. So I was never going to settle. But I also was like, you know what? I'm going to do this and just invest in myself. So it was a matter of an investment in myself. So I wasn't just paying $7K just to vibe, right? It's $7K was my office. It was my podcast recording studio. It was where I filmed any of my content. So
tax write-off.
So I did that too. But what ended up happening was I realized I was in this rat race that I could never win. That I just wouldn't, it's not in my favor, right? Because the algorithm doesn't even understand. The people don't understand that this is possible for someone who looks like me. And when I finally, I've left my lease now and I'm a nomad, I'm traveling around the world. And I really realized it was truly a rat race. I was in that system. But again, I love to tell people I could afford it. It was fun. I enjoyed it. If I'm going to go back and ever get a house now, I'll probably get something similar because that's the prices around the New York area. A 1-bedroom would cost you anywhere from $5,000 to $9,000. A 2-bedroom would cost you anywhere from $7,000 to $12,000. And it goes on and on and on, especially if you want to live in Manhattan, which is the city. Yeah.
And can you talk about what made you want to transition to be a nomad? Now, I want to hear, like, where have you traveled to? What is, like, feeling like joy right now when you're traveling?
So I'm not, maybe someone said I have commitment issues. Maybe that's it. I don't know, guys. But life in America is really interesting because, and this might be a hot take, am I too loud if I say that for a lot of creators, especially now within the influencer industry, it's a achievement focused community. Let me explain what that means.
Yeah, society, yeah.
It's a society, essentially, right? So it's like, oh, your first car, your first apartment, your first house, you get married, when is the next kid happening, and the next kid, and school. Like, there's always another level you have to hit for you to be relevant, especially if you're not a personality creator. If you're a lifestyle creator, I think a lot of creators don't deep this enough. If you're a lifestyle creator, people are looking forward to what's next in the lifestyle for them to achieve it. So when folks are in school, people are waiting for graduation. After graduation, your first job, your first car, your first home, your first this, your first that. And I've seen that rat race happen over and over and over. And I see a lot of creators get sunk into the, when there's a lull, like you've gotten the apartment, you've gotten the car, now you're just...
routine.
There, it's a routine. What next? And for a lot of people who are interested in business, who might not want to be business owners, life now becomes a bit more stagnant. They're not sure. And that's where we get the comments about the folks who are doing matcha, or the people who do the matcha, or the Target runs, or the Target runs, because for the lifestyle, there's nothing more to do. And there's content spaces for that too, right? There's Amazon shop and TikTok shop and Target shop. So you can also like monetize that version. But for creators who, someone like me who doesn't enjoy that, at some point I was like, what am I actually doing? Because as a personality creator, what do I enjoy doing? And I love trying things. I love, like, that's my goal in life, is to experience and try new things. Because especially as a young Black woman, we're oftentimes told exactly what we need to do. And I've always not fit that mold. So now I'm like, I just want to explore. Like, everyone's like, oh, we should go to this and that. I'm like, I don't really want to. Like, I just want to, I want to travel. I want to climb on Mount Everest. I actually want to go to Kilimanjaro. I was just showing you guys a TikTok about that. I want to sleep in a safari. I want to sleep under a tent. I want to try camping. I want to jump off a building. Like, those are the things I want to do. I don't know if I'm going to do it because my poor mother, but those are the life, that's the kind of life I want to live. So I think in New York, I found myself in that cycle now of going to the influencer events, going to the same parties, doing the same rounds. Like, a full year in New York is pretty certain if you don't have travel involved in your daily routine. So I decided to step out of it because I had to go back to my core. And on my vision board this year, I wrote, do you more. And so when the time for my lease was ending, I had all these plans to travel because I was going to go be in London for a month and a half. I was going to be in Nigeria for a month and a half. That was already 3 months or 4 months out of the year. So it made no sense for me to be paying $600 in rent if I'm not going to be home. And so I was like, what do I actually want to do? I want to travel, and I can, and I have the resources to now. So let's do that. So I have a bucket list of 30 things I want to do before I turn 30. I turn 30, June 25, 2027. You're all invited. We're doing a party in Lagos. Well, I'm like, we'll carry Gilly. So I'm going to let you know when it comes. It's a Friday, so get ready. But I'm doing a bucket list, and I have 30 things that I'm going to achieve before I turn 30. And this is ranging from going to Trinidad for mass, like flying, jumping off a plane, going camping under night, seeing the northern lights, like stuff that I've taken for granted and stuff that I've never been able to do because I spent 10 years in America trying to chase the American dream. And now it feels like I'm sitting in my American dream and my dreams now, and I can do it. So, yeah.
You know, it's funny. There's this quote by this philosopher, Naval, that I think I sent it to you one time, and I said, Sophie, you literally encompass this for me. And it goes like this. It says, when working, surround yourself with people more successful than you. When playing, surround yourself with people more happier than you. Right? And I remember just saying to someone that, like you just said, your cheat code is just being you. But people try to think like it's something that's being manufactured, or it's like, no, she's authentically being her. And the role that she gets to play, like even now sitting with you, is you unlock so many doors, not just for even young women, but even people in general, right? Which is like, what does it look like to live your absolute human self, right? Like I call it absolute human flourishing, right? Which is like you're able to step into your authentic self and then go show even young Nigerians what it feels like to really be within yourself globally, and young Africans as well. So I'm really happy about this phase you're in.
Thank you. I also feel like a huge part of our content, especially for young Black women, is aspirational, right? We don't often see relatability. And I want to be in that niche. Emma Chamberlain comes to mind. Emma Chamberlain is the most relatable white girl a lot of the white girls think, right? She's not anymore. She has a mansions and she's in the movies. She's all these things. Yeah. But at the core of it, her job, her role was just to be Emma. And I remember when I was watching creators, and I think, again, this is very much out of the Nigerian context, because you have like, when you're competing with your peers who look like you, there's nuance. There's different types of creators in Nigeria. There's a relatable Black girl. There's the alté. There's the fashionista. There's the lifestyle creator. So you're allowed to have different layers to yourself here. In the American market, you're a Black girl. And you have to be the kind of palatable Black girl that the American audience wants to see.
Exactly.
And if you're not, they put you in boxes. So are you going to be a Quen Blackwell? Or are you going to be a Simi Moonlight? Are you going to be Anna Chiang? Are you, you know, they're different level. Are you going to be on Any Given Sunday? And are you going to be the brand friendly Black girl? Are you going to be the crazy Black girl? Are you going to be the Black girl who doesn't wear braids or only has her hair out? Are you going to be the Black girl who's a model? They make sure you're in that box. And then once they put you in that box, you're sitting in that box. There's no shaking. There's no moving. And when there's any variation of a move, now you're, I don't know what's going on now. So I think that's why it was also important for me to just double down on me being my personality, no matter what, like, no matter how far I go, how I want to be able to still show my audience the behind the scenes of what life as a creator looks like and be real and just raw about it. Because not every day is fashion week and lifestyle and glamorous outfits and fancy heels. Some days are crying because my mom says she hates me today. Some days are love stuff. Some days are going on trips and having some fun on the trip, or too much fun. You know what I mean? Like, it's just life just happens that way. I want people to see that we can enjoy life when it's not as curated as we're used to seeing online.
I want you to break down the juxtaposition, and that's a big word. I'm glad I get to use it on this podcast. But no, I want you to break down the juxtaposition between, you're born in Nigeria, you're going to school here. Mm-hmm. We don't really know anything about racism like that. Most of us are Black, right? Yeah. And because the same thing happened with me. Mm-hmm. You move to America and you get introduced to race or racism, right? And then you've been there for almost 10 plus years and your worldview is mostly shaped by maybe Black or white. And then you come to Nigeria because you were talking about this, and then you're put back into this whole classicism thing where there's no race, right? How have you been able to navigate it to? Can you break it down for our viewers where I came to America, I now have to understand the framework of race. Mm-hmm. But when I'm now back in Nigeria, I now have to understand the framework of classism. Like, what does that look like for you?
Ooh, that is deep. Oh, very deep. Because when I saw, again, who was I have a story shot, guys? So my understanding of race was my first year in America. I actually went to school for the first year in West Virginia. And if you're listening, you don't know what West Virginia is. West Virginia is, if you ever think of the American ghetto, that's the white ghetto, not Black ghetto.
Rednecks.
I'm telling you, like, people, I'm not even exaggerating yet, I promise you, people sleeping with their cousins, that deep West Virginia. Like, this is very much like the Appalachian Mountains, like deep, deep in there. For context, they also suffer with obesity, and that's huge there because there's no good food, no healthy stores. It's horrible, right? I mean, their huts pretty much look like our huts. Like, I remember going there and being like, hey, is this the America you guys told me to come to? Because are you kidding me? This is not the America I was told. So I was
Your chicken was born in Manassas.
Manassas is Northern Virginia.
It's the same thing.
Northern Virginia is good.
Okay, yeah. Okay, Manassas is big, okay? I got you.
Prince George's
all
County.
All these West Coast people be trying to.
Like, I know, they really try.
But so I was in West Virginia and I just started class and people around me were just very interesting. But first day, usually in American or in college system, they give you a paper to fill out, like your name, blah, 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 for the professor. And one professor at the time, when I filled out, I put other and I put African because the tick is Black / African-American. Now, I don't have a blue passport. So in my head, I'm not Black or African-American because I don't have a blue passport. That was my understanding what race was. And so when he got back, he literally calls me when class was ending. He's like, oh, like, no, like, you tick Black or African-American, you Black. I'm like, oh, no, I'm not Black. I'm actually African. Because like, in my mind, this is fresh off the boat, Sophie, 2014. I'm not Black. What do you mean I'm Black? I'm not Black. I'm African. And he goes, y'all Negroes are the same. Not the cameraman doing hot.
What? He said, teacher?
Like, teacher, professor in college.
He said, y'all Negroes are the same.
So see, now this is the thing. This is someone in 2014, right? I just came to America. The word Negro or nigger does not mean anything to me, right? Because not because I don't know history, but because at that point, I didn't understand the impact of the slur. I'd heard it was a slur, but I didn't understand the impact of it because it had no impact on me. So I remember going, okay, so I just give him the paper and I just click Black. I didn't even feel any way. Like, I could tell he was upset, but I couldn't understand
what
why he was
upset about.
I don't know.
How dare she try to other herself? Try to,
yeah.
Like, I know a nigga when I see a nigga.
He said Negro. He didn't say nigga. He said Negro.
Yeah,
he
but
said,
that's what he meant, basically.
I know.
You
know what I mean? Like, Negro is even deeper. Nigga is even casual.
How dare you disrespect my eyesight?
This is crazy.
So he said that, and then I just go about my day. So I'm yapping in the international student office, and I'm telling them, like, oh, guys, by the way, like, am I Black or African-American? Like, what's going on? And they're like, why you asked that? I'm like, oh, because this professor said I should put Black and African-American, but I'm African. And they're like, oh. And then like, he said, that's who you must report it. And I was like, no, 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 it's fine. I'm not reporting it. Like, it's not that serious. I don't want wahala. I just got here. Let me not know somebody should not send me back. Like, let me not send me back. Or like, I don't want wahala. So that was my first interaction with race. And what was even crazier was white people then were nice to me than Black people then in West Virginia. And I never understood the concept of it. So like, I was close to the white people. A lot of the white people loved international students. And I didn't understand the nuance of that because, again, there's this, what is the hierarchy, immigrant hierarchy thing that they play around in American law, where like immigrants are seen as better, more efficient than Black creators.
Yeah, so African Americans.
And African Americans, which is also a nuance to be had because we see our people, I hear like uncles and aunts talk about how like, oh yeah, African Americans don't work, blah, blah, blah. But it's all a matter of colonization. It's all a way to keep all of us down. Yeah. Like you're no better than everybody else. We all look the same. They're just trying to warp your mind to get more resources out of you. I say all that to say that was my first relation to race. And I think throughout my years, I went to Louisiana. Now Louisiana is also Black Mecca, right? Like especially deep in Louisiana. And then the Black people were nice. And I was going over to stay in grandma's house and we had red beans and rice, which is very much like red beans and rice that we have here. And their soups were just similar to ours. And they even have Creole culture and they have some Yoruba facets to them too. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting. And so I started assimilating. And a lot of people talk about how I sound very American or I be very American. But I'm saying I went into a new country. Yeah. I would always try to learn from where I'm at, the good, the bad, and the ugly, to then take from that to even better myself. So I think that was my goal, essentially, when I lived there. And through that, I started, you know, growing, learning more about Black relations, African Americans. And at the core of it, guys, it's the crab in the bucket mentality. Yeah. We're all fighting for the same resources. And we might think you're better than somebody else, but I tell you, at the core of it, the policeman will shoot you down regardless of what accent you have.
Because all he sees is this.
All they see is Black. Yeah. And we see that with the current administration, but I'm not going to talk about that because I'm going to get in trouble. The point is, there's a lot to be said about race relations in America, especially with the diaspora. Coming back home to Nigeria, I think when I first came back, I remember being so excited. And I'd never been gone that long, that people look like me on TV. Like, I forgot the concept of ads where, like, it's you. Like, they're not even trying to pick a light skin, a mixed race, a white person, a person with a dog. Like, it's just, they just cast anyone. Like, you're dark skin, brown skin, light skin. Like, you rarely even see light skin people in Nigerian ads. Like, it's just see Black. And I remember being, oh my God, this is great. And everyone's looking at me like, you know, Nigeria, what's wrong with you? But I don't think they understand that.
Psychological.
It warps your brain when you don't see people who look like you. The competition is different because if I tell this all the time, as a creator in America, I do make a lot more money. But I am telling you, I would be a lot more successful if I was a creator in Nigeria. I say this every time. And that's because I should have, let me not toot my own horn, but five million plus followers right now if I was a Nigerian creator.
Yeah.
Or more.
Easily.
Yeah.
With the amount of work ethic, with consistency, what kind of thing I create, I should have global podcasting. I should be flying around. I should be Bonang, the South African host, who I think about all the time when I see how great she's doing. I was like, there's opportunity here because all your audience is packed in like a bucket. Like the audience is there. You're talking directly to them. So they are able to latch onto you. In America, your audience is in like a little maze.
Yeah.
They're in mazes. Maybe you could grab them from here, you grab them from here, you grab them from there. Because maybe you're a West Coast creator, you're a New York creator, you're like South creator, you are a beauty creator, you're a Black creator too. Oh, so you're not a Black? Are you brand friendly? Are you not? What do you speak about? How do you speak about it? What tone do you use? Who's your manager? Are they white? Are they Black? So there's so much more nuance to it that it drives you even insane thinking about how much potential is lost because you're not a white creator, because you're in a majority white land. And then for Nigerian with classism, I had to realize that humans were always human and we'll always find ways to give ourselves hierarchies.
Status.
And I think Nigeria's issue with classism is something that shocked me, but didn't surprise me in a way. Like I knew it was shocking to see, but I wasn't also surprised by the nuance of it. But as a creator, I don't think it has done anything for me except just understand that there's more ways to play around getting money here, getting paid here. It's about who you know, how you speak to people, who you're supposed to be talking to, who's the presence of here that I can talk to here to get to here. Yeah. So it's less about your work ethic or your goals and more about who you know.
Does it feel like you're stepping back into your mom's like political career when you're navigating Nigeria? It's like, okay, cool. I was raised with this. I understand this part better.
Yes. I think Nigeria's been, everybody's been laughing because I kept saying Lagos is stressing me out. And I think I always want to say also Lagos specifically because I feel like Lagos is its own entity. In Lagos, it feels like Lagos is about the creator economy, especially. They're still about 2 to 3 years behind, right? And honestly, this is the opportunity to call some people out.
Yes.
Thank
Please
you.
Please proceed.
Am I too loud if I say the managers in Lagos pissing me the fudge off? They treat their creators like their creators work for them. And that's something that's been so confusing to me. Creators here are indebted to their managers. Yes, ma. Yes, sir. Okay, sir. Yes, that's how creators move here.
Why?
And I don't understand it because you're the one making the manager money. So why is your manager in charge of your well-being? Like, I've been in spaces where these creators are like looking up to their manager as to what's next, because again, it's the respectability politics, it's the classism, it's the I made you and I'll put you here. You need to understand me and respect me. Like, I would see followers talking about how, oh yeah, you left your manager, you don't have respect anymore. On top of all the work you're doing, pisses me off. So am I so loud if I say Lagos managers piss me the fudge off and they need to move better? Because I think Lagos' creator economy is still about 2 to 3 years behind, and the creators still don't understand or are not able to express the business side of things. And especially because not everybody wants to be a content creator, right? So everybody has a phone, but they forget the impact of virality, of strategy, of intention around actually creating an audience around your content, your personality.
And you know, I'll add some color here because, you know, I moved back a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. And so even though primarily brand deals and my income I get as a creator is 100% US right now, right? What I've realized is that just talking to different creators and just talking to different people in Nigeria, the challenge is that creators don't understand where to make the money. And to be honest, it's a mystery. It's not. So in America, there's literally like PR agencies you can reach out to. Yeah. There is literally an influencer manager at said brand I can send a LinkedIn to. I can network with different brand companies. Like there's a system that even if you don't know much in the US, you'll figure it out. In Nigeria, there's really you as a creator, your manager that gets in between, and then a company. Yeah. And it's typically a marketer manager that doesn't know anything, that doesn't know how much to pay someone. Yeah. And I know even me and Eche, you know, we're figuring it out with this YouTube, and it's been very interesting talking to people and them assuming you pay one price and it gets everything.
Everything, yeah.
In America, white listing,
usage rights.
So. You want to use my photo on a website, you pay me for that. Oh, there was a union worker in my video that you got to pay for that. Like there's all these different things that has been set in America, and unfortunately it's not been set.
Systems.
Well, we can say that about anything in Nigeria.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, our systems are an issue. And I also want to point out that that's why I think the managers have a little more power here, because now if you have a manager who knows this person and that person, and you can say, okay, they're the ones that will come for deals. But I also want to shout out the Nigerian creators who are focusing now on investing in like TikTok and going live, because that way it's direct income that has nothing to do with your manager and nothing to do with anybody else but you and your talent and your work. And because I've heard a lot of that same rhetoric of who do we go to, what brands are understanding. Even when brands reach out to me and I tell them my price, they're looking at me like,
that's the thing we're talking about.
That's your price? I said, talk. You ask me, or you not ask me, if I won't lie to you. At least what they're paying me. If you can't pay me that way, I understand. But
that's what your apartment is costing.
All that I'll start from.
But actually, I want to now switch to your podcast, right? Yes. I want you to talk about it. What made you start a podcast, and where do you envision it over the next few years?
Guys, I want to be the next female Kevin Hart. And not necessarily from the comedy standpoint, even though I do love comedy, but from the versatility and personality of what Kevin Hart represents. When you think of Kevin Hart, you think short, funny man, right? Like, I want to think of people, when I think of oddity, as bald, bold girl. That's it. Bald, bold girl. Or let me find maybe a different word for girl. Like
BBG.
Woman. BBG. See? Period. Like, that's kind of the entity that I want to become. Be multifaceted. So after within the influencer industry, there's very few next steps, right? Because as creators, that's where a lot of creators suffer with, especially with age comes into play. That's where you see a lot of 19-year-old influencers going, oh my God, guys, I'm struggling. I'm not doing well. Look at them, like, you're just 19, no? Like, you still have 25 to go, and then 30 and 35. So you can't say you're not doing well now because you just started. So if you're starting a creator journey, you're making money, and then you're doing brand deals, then usually, like, you get to the point where, like, okay, you're doing consistent brand deals. You have access. If you're a fashion influencer, you do the fashion weeks, and then you do, like, maybe some certain things. And there's sort of, like, what's next, right? And again, like we talked about earlier, you can try to go the business route, build your own business, products, you know, bring your own product, stuff like that. But not everybody wants to do that. So what next? For me, I've always wanted to host. I love hosting. And when I started having conversations with my team about hosting, they were like, well, we want to see that content. We want to see a proof of it. How do we know you're a good host? And I was like, well, I am. I know I can do it. Well, yeah, but we want you to tell us. And that's where the podcast came from. Because I always also love yapping. But if TikTok goes away today, if Instagram goes away today, what do I have to show for my talent, for me to then take to traditional media, digital media, to say this is what I can do? And that's where my podcast sort of like emerged, especially because I'm thinking of it more as like my resume now. I've started building resumes for brands. So whenever a brand reaches out to me, I can record, I can do video stuff. So because of my YouTube channel, I can be a host, I can be a presenter because of my podcast. I can act because of my skits on my channel. So now there's like resumes of things available for anyone who's looking to see what the Odyssey can do. So my Tila was born from simply that. I just wanted to make sure I had a resume of a hosting reel of some sort. I've also always wanted a space for me to just yap and yap away about any and everything. I think a lot of the podcasts we do have, it's usually like gist or mess. We talk about that drama. And I want my Tila to be the space where shame goes to die. Like, I am so shameless. You cannot tell me. Like, when I tell you, the people that count, like, they come to me and they say, oh, you told me, like, this is a crazy thing to bring up, but some random girl comes to me the other day. She was like, oh my God, I just masturbated because of you. And I said,
wait, what?
Excuse me?
Wait, what? Did they DM you that?
No, like, in person, talked about it. And I was like, what? And they were like, your masturbation episode. I said, girl, I forgot I did that. I was like, oh, shoot. Yeah, girl. And I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, how was it? And we had a long conversation because come to find out that she'd never done that before. She didn't know how to. And she'd actually like been going through some like internal sex therapy, something. And she was scared of it. And I swear to you guys, when I heard that conversation, I went, oh, so maybe this is why I do it. Because at the end of the day, like,
demystifies it.
Especially for like African women, like, sex is so taboo. Like, life and relationships are so taboo. Like, for men especially, like, there's this hunger to not know but know, and they're being creepy about it. But when we talk about stuff, it takes the taboo-ness out of it. Why teenage boys play with their things all day is because no one talks to them about it.
Yeah.
So now they're curious. Why young girls fall into teenage pregnancy, fall into like sex STDs and stuff is because no one talks about it. My mom never talked to me about sex.
Yeah.
Ever. Like, I didn't even know what it was. Like, I just knew that my brother would sit down in the room. Shout out to my brother. And I knew like they're watching porn or he's watching porn. The magazines that I know he was watching. But as a girl, I didn't know what that was. So if he left his phone around and I picked it up and I saw it, now I'm like, ooh, what is that? That's curiosity. Like, the younger cousins who are probably going around, we're going to pick that up too. No one is talking to them about it. Yeah. No one knows it. It demystifies it. Right. So when people are like, oh, why would you talk about stuff like that? Why wouldn't I? Because if I remember when I went viral and I had the bikini on and an uncle came on and he's like, you have destroyed my life. You had this and that. I said, uncle, you think I'm sexy? And he said, what? I said, you think I'm sexy now? He said, shut up. Why would you say that? I said, because uncle, in that video, you're telling me, I was saying my armpits are black and my coochie is black and my knees are black, but I'm okay because I'm beautiful, because a lot of women struggle with hyperpigmentation. But you saw a video and you immediately went to breast and bum bum. So that means you are the problem, because you didn't listen to the audio because you're so blinded by hunger for what you're seeking. He never spoke to me again, actually. Uncle, hello. But that's how I think. And it might be different. It might be like out of what people are used to. But that's why I'm the oddity. Like, if you're coming into my space, if you're coming to the podcast, you're expecting conversations like this.
No, honestly, this conversation, like, there's so many ways to take it. But I wanted to bring it back to, you know, you talked about the assault, right?
Yeah.
And I know therapy also helps with that. But what did it look like dealing with the anger from it. And I think the reason why I'm asking this is usually it's delayed processing, mm-hmm. right? So in the moment when it happens, you might not be really sure what's going on.
Yeah.
You said for 3 other months, this is what was happening. Yeah. But then you escaped to America and you're there. At what moment did you sit with that? Like, at what point did you sit with it and process it and, you know, heal through it as well?
You know, it's crazy. I did not heal through it until 2021. And that happened in 2014 for me. And I think why was because after that situation, and again, this is actually, I've never spoken more about this. I was assaulted 2 more times by actual intimate partners. And the last time that actually triggered something of me having to sit down with myself and just understand it was a barber situation. So I actually was assaulted by a barber. And I actually was in the barbing salon, Phoenix Salon Suites in Virginia. And I was, you know, one of those like suites where you rent a room. So the barber rented a room out.
And it's just you and the barber.
And it's just you and the barber in the room. And because barbershops always made me so uncomfortable. And I thought, okay, if it was one-on-one, it might be better, especially because like they have a social media presence, nothing crazy would happen. And this bastard, that's how you know the emotion is still there, had his razor. You know when like you're doing a fade? And I remember he put his razor on my neck and proceeded to bring out his penis and started like touching himself and touching me with it and threatening me not to move. And he was like, why is a girl like you bald? You're just a temptation. And crazy, crazy, crazy shit like that happened. And I remember leaving that scenario just wanting to be safe, right? Because as a young woman too, you're taught to be safe. Just don't fight it. Just don't make any sudden moves. Because over the past couple of years, I'm thinking about what my mom said about it's your fault because you're looking the way you look or you're talking too much. And the power is oftentimes in the man. Like you're like, oh, don't let the man do this too much for you. And I got home and my boyfriend at the time was home and I told him what happened and he was livid and he was angry and I said, I didn't want to fight it. He said, no, we're going to have it. I didn't want to fight it. And then he asked me, why didn't you want to fight it? And he meant it genuinely. He was like, why? And I was like, because I've never fought it before. And he was like, why have you never fought it before? And I broke down crying. And I feel like I cried for so long after that. And that's when therapy also helped with unpacking that. When you're taught to blame yourself for something that happens to you, you're taught to just not fight it and create a space for you. So I think it's helped me be a better woman and more vocal about a lot of things that have happened to me. People wonder now with my podcast and things I talk about, they're like, oh, we never knew you were this way. We never knew you were so vocal. And I was like, because I've been silenced for so long. Like if you read my earlier blog entries, you would think I was borderline depressed. Like the girl who's always smiling, but you actually don't feel joy. Like that's the kind of shit I used to write. Cause I was internalizing so many things because as women we're supposed to, you're supposed to be the strong Black woman. You're supposed to be this and you're supposed to be that. And I think 2021, 2022 was a time where I decided enough was enough. And I would always choose me in this lifetime. I'll always fight for me. I'll be my biggest cheerleader, my most vocal cheerleader. I will own who I am and no one else is going to take that away from me. And I took my power back. And it's been a wild journey ever since because I can see the change in me. The way I move, the way I process things, the way I deal with people in friendships. It's just I'm in a whole different mindset now. I think it's also age. Like I'm 28 now. I'm growing up. I'm finding myself now too. I'm like, people always say like when you're in your 30s, nobody can tell you shit. And I can generally feel like I'm getting this. When like no one can tell me anything that I don't already know.
You know, it's funny because I was reading this book, The Body Keeps Score. And it's about this whole, you know, the triggers and you being able to spot it. So you, like, and this is really more from the audience's perspective because I think there are people who are dealing with some of these things as well.
Yeah.
And they might not even know how to vocalize it. What did it look like for you to get to the point where you're like, I understand my triggers? And maybe before you might not have had the words to articulate it.
Yeah.
And then therapy maybe gave you the language for it, right? What did that process look like for you where you're sometimes with the triggers, it can occur in different scenarios. Even people around you might not even understand. Even your loved ones or even your romantic partners might not understand. But what did it look like for you to now finally get the language to be able to articulate it for yourself, have the awareness of it, and then now be able to communicate it to the people around you?
I think it looked like freedom in many ways. And I think what that meant was I stopped being ashamed of how I felt. Because I'm a big emotion person. Like, I love to feel big. I stopped being ashamed of it. And that helped me and equipped me to bring better people around me, too. I used to be terrible at setting boundaries. I was a terrible people pleaser. And those are all symptoms of abuse, of struggle, of not feeling like you're good enough, not feeling like you're important enough. And over time, I started to learn that with these things, the best thing you can do for yourself is love yourself enough to be your biggest and loudest cheerleader. And we hear this a lot, self-love. I mean, I went viral for self-love, right? I went viral at a time where I didn't even have a lot of self-love in me. And it's shown in my content how different life looks like when you truly, truly fall in love with you and you're able to set that. In my relationships, I'm more vocal about what I want and what I do not take. I start cutting people off and I communicated with them that you don't serve me anymore. And I am someone who would go above and beyond for people. But if you're not able to do the same, it's okay because we're not all created equal. But if you're not able to meet with some respect, then I don't want to be a part of it. So it's little conversations like that that changed my outlook in life, but it also gave me freedom. I think we get scared when we set boundaries because we think that people are going to leave. But if they were meant to leave, let them leave, right? Boundaries are meant to protect you and not everybody else. And if you start getting to understand that, life drastically changes because people would always go. In fact, if you set a boundary, most people would try to break that boundary because people would always try to serve themselves. So how dare you not serve you? That's all I would say.
Your word, a sermon.
We created the Afropolitan podcast because we wanted to make sure we tell the stories of those who came before us and those who are coming in front of us.
Our stories deserve to be documented and remembered.
And over here at Afropolitan, our drink of choice is Inveroche, which is a gin from South Africa because we believe African brands are global. So Eche, what are you toasting to?
To our builders, our innovators, to show that Black brilliance exists worldwide.
I am toasting to African creativity. I feel like the world is just blossoming with beautiful African storytellers.
Here's to legacy.
And stories worth sharing.
So babes, I'm always talking to you about investing. How's your journey going so far?
It started because you've been on my head for the past 6 months about investing, and you'll be proud of me because I actually found an app I love. It's called RiseVest. And actually what I love about it is that you can start with $10 and it automates everything for you. So literally I just go into the app and literally it's investing for me every single day.
Yeah, because we know you're not going to be a trader anytime soon. But with RiseVest, you're going to be able to invest in US stocks, right? Fixed income, real estate, etc. Right? And so I'm happy you're finally on board.
And you know, the funny thing too is I always tell my girls that as women, we're not investing enough, we're not talking about it, and we're not having these conversations. So I shared it in all my group chats. So you can find RiseVest on the Apple and Google Play Store.
Okay. Make sure to use code Afropolitan so that they know that we sent you. You know how every week we sit down with people who've done it, people who've built, people who've led movements, people who've created culture. What if you could do more than just listen to them? That is why we built Convo by Afropolitan. On Convo, you're able to book one-on-one video calls with in-demand experts from Africa and the diaspora. Go to convo.vip to get access to your next mentor, because sometimes one convo can change your entire path. So we're going to transition to our rapid fire segment, which is where we ask you the first question.
Okay.
Or we ask you a question, the first thought that comes into your mind. That's what you're going for.
Okay.
What's your favorite Nigerian food?
Oh, jollof rice and goat meats.
Jollof rice and goat
meats. Jollof rice and goat meats that I make myself. I make the best jollof.
Okay. What's your favorite city that you've traveled to so far?
Ooh, gosh, you guys are going to hate this, but I love New York City.
New York.
I'm not going to lie. I've not even traveled to anywhere. I've not traveled to a lot of places, so this could change. But I'm always, New York is home.
Really?
Really?
New York is home.
Okay. Well, maybe what city in the world do you want to travel to, in which African city?
Ooh, okay. I love that. I want to go to Nairobi. I've read a lot about Kenya, especially the Silicon Valley of Africa, something I didn't even know existed. So I want to go to Nairobi. And what else was that? What was that?
And just what city? Like
what city in the world? This is so random, but I really, really, really want to go to somewhere in Greece. I've just never been to Greece, and I'm a huge Greek mythology type of girl. So maybe I'm going to go to Greece, and then like I want to backpack across Europe. So I'm going to do that too, just for the fun of it. I've never been, so we'll see.
I think I did that last year.
You did?
I crossed it off.
Like backpack?
Proper backpack,
like
backpack? Yes.
No,
a backpack.
No, you didn't really backpack.
I had a backpack and a carry-on. I'm Nigerian.
Did you stay in hostels or did you stay in hotels?
No, he did not.
See, Sophie, let's relax.
he said Sophie, really, let's really relax. Backpack.
Sophie, I have a bad back.
He did not backpack.
No. We backpacked. I had a backpack on my back. And I had a carry-on and I moved, you know, but hostels, let's relax, please. I need hostel in Magada. I'm not going back.
Yeah. What's your favorite social media platform?
Ooh, I love Instagram. I know people, I'm an Instagram girly core and core. That's where my first community was. That's where Instagram is me at the core of it. I love it. I know they stress me out with them algorithms and the changes, and they just need to stop doing what they're doing. But at the core, I'm always an Instagram girl.
Yeah. And then the last question we ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair and whose story needs to be told?
Who do I want to see next here and whose story needs to be told? Ooh, that's a good one.
This is a plug, because usually when people manifest here, we end up bringing them. So
here, I'm thinking. Gosh, guys, there's so many people.
You can name a few.
Okay, I love to see Manny Wells.
Manny
Wells is really good, and I think of that from like the DACA immigrant perspective. I think he's amazing. Ty Aina is a huge travel creator, but Ty is also one of the maybe top three black male travel creators in the world.
Amazing.
And like, because with his numbers, there's no one else doing it like he does, but because he's African, the world doesn't take a look. So I think that's a conversation to be had. And let's see, I think those two, Manuel's and Tayana. Let's do that.
Before you go, can we break down, because obviously we're familiar with this and we've talked about this, but just even the disparity between being a Nigerian creator with a YouTube channel that starts off in Nigeria versus a Nigerian creator, or versus us who have YouTube channels that are like we're created in the US, and just the nuance of that, right? Because it's like, if we had known when we're all starting YouTube channels back then that long term, like, you might as well have called your cousin in America and say, open up an account there for me, right? Like, can you break down the nuances that you're seeing in the differences between creators in Africa and creators based in the US?
All the social media platforms are run by the West. That's the best way to explain it, right? And their hubs, we all know, the Facebooks, the WhatsApp, the YouTubes, all of it, they're all geared towards an American audience at the core. They're American businesses, they're American everything, except for TikTok. And I feel like we see that because TikTok also has a very specific algorithm that lets people win in a way we've never seen before. Like, the TikTok growth is crazy, because I feel like in many ways, an unbridled social media platform should exist the way TikTok did. And of course, TikTok America had to just be TikTok America, and they started changing the algorithm. So now you can see the influence of racism and classism and social structures influencing how folks in TikTok now move. But at the core of it, 2020, it didn't matter what you look like, who you were. If you were seen, you got some level of a following, because that's how humans work. And I bring that to YouTube, as in, YouTube wants to service the American audience, because American brands pay for folks to run ads on your channel. So because of that, if you don't have American dollars, they don't rank you high for people to get paid from. So I see a lot of that with their CRM. So I think me and Tyler will go back and forth on, if he has a video with 1 million views, he'd probably get paid $1,000, maybe $2,000. If I got a video with 1 million views, I could probably get paid $5,000 to $7,000, depending on where the views are coming from. If they're coming from America, probably got UK, Canada, probably more. And from Nigeria and a heavy African audience, less. Because again, US brands don't see the use essentially for their money and their audience here. Because again, you see with Netflix, like Netflix charges less for subscribers here than they do for America.
Spotify,
because again, Spotify too, because again, numbers, they wouldn't pay their folks here the same amount too. So it's disappointing, but from a business standpoint, I understand it, right? I don't like it. I wish it wasn't so, because then I want to make money across the board. But when you start looking at these social media platforms as businesses, it helps you navigate things a lot better, because then you're able to be more strategic about what platforms you want to be on. If you post on YouTube Shorts, you have more outreach, because YouTube Shorts goes to not a focus in America, but everywhere else, right? TikTok is the same way too. And you see a lot of Nigerian creators thrive on TikTok and get paid on TikTok, because TikTok Live lets anybody gift you. So if I gift you $700 on TikTok Live, you're probably going to get $500. You know what I mean? Because that's how TikTok would work, essentially.
You know, it's so funny, because this thing is something we tried to break down. I'm so glad you were able to share it. Sophie, thank you for coming
by. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.